loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The G7 summit kicks off today in Japan. Thousands of Japanese people are in the streets demanding that the United States remove its military bases from their country. But what's on the agenda of the G7? The refugee crisis, war in Syria, the ongoing struggle in the Ukraine, and why does the G7 still exist? A State Department internal audit sharply criticizes former Secretary of State and presidential candidate Hillary Clinton over her unilateral decision to conduct all official State Department business on her personal email server. Is this report window dressing, or may Clinton face legal consequences? The so-called refugee deal between Turkey and the EU seems to be completely blocked as both sides pursue competing agendas. What's at stake for the refugees, and can we expect new, sharp political turns inside of Turkey and inside the EU countries? But first, we turn to the G7. We are joined by Eric Dratzer. He is a co-founder of StopImperialism.org. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks again, Brian.
So, G7, President Obama's arriving in Japan, but there are huge mass protests because another Japanese person in Okinawa was killed by a former Marine, raped and killed. There are, of course, mass protests are not new in Japan. People are demanding U.S. troops get out of Japan. That sort of sets the stage for the G7 summit. But what is the G7? Is it useful? What, you know, why does it exist at this point?
Well, I think the question of is the G7 useful is particularly interesting because we have to really ask ourselves, useful to whom? Is it useful for international relations? Is it useful for fostering mutual cooperation and guaranteeing peace and stability in the world? I would argue no. Is it useful for the United States as a political platform from which it's able to marshal support from its various allies and proxies and use that to its own ends? Well, then absolutely. That's part of the reason why the G7 really exists. Why, when Russia was basically booted out of the G8 over the conflict in Ukraine and associated issues, this is what Putin was really pointing to when he talked about the sort of irrelevance of these type of multilateral platforms, because rather than something like the G20, which is seen as the more inclusive of these groups, one that has at least a little bit more representation of the global south and of developing countries and of other non-Western states, the G7 really acts as essentially the Washington's plaything, and it, I think, needs to be understood in that way, similar to how NATO is really Washington's plaything, that is to say the military arm of its power projection in Europe and really around the world. And so when we think about the G7, I think we really need to think about it in relation to those countries that participated in it, and specifically in relation to the U.S. and the projection of U.S. power.
G7, the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Japan. The last to be joined was Canada. I mean, it doesn't have China, it doesn't have Russia, it doesn't have India, it doesn't have Brazil. It looks like the old colonial imperial world, you know, of course, with some additions. I guess I don't know how we would place Canada and all of that. But it seems like something that just is a leftover multilateral platform for perhaps U.S. domination. There are big contradictions, though, within those G7 countries. The head of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Ischinger, said, quote, the G7 is not capable of dealing with major international crises alone. Neither the crisis in Ukraine nor the conflict in Syria can be resolved without Russia's participation. Is he right, especially where issues such as Syria are concerned? And how does Russia view it now that, you know, they've been booted out? Does Russia care?
Well, does Russia, from a pride perspective, doesn't care. They won't allow their pride to be hurt by U.S. policies in that way. But obviously, Russia cares in regards to its ability to engage with as many issues in as many corners of the world as it possibly can. I mean, that is really part of the diplomatic power that Russia wields, both in its own region and internationally. So they obviously care to some degree, but they don't care in the larger scheme of things, because Russia obviously has a seat at the UN Security Council, which is really where muscles can be flexed when it comes to these major issues such as Ukraine, such as Syria, and so forth. And I just want to interrogate this question very quickly about the ability or lack thereof of the G7 to address some of these key issues. It's not simply because Russia and China and India and these other countries are not included that issues such as Ukraine and Syria can't be resolved by the G7. It is because of the very nature of these conflicts that the G7 can't be a forum for resolution here. These conflicts are deeply connected to international geopolitical issues. Obviously, Russia's engagement in Syria, obviously Russia's involvement near its border with Ukraine, and the conflict in that country. These things, I think, necessitate a forum that is more equal, that is more representative, not only representing that it is Russia and China's interests, but representing the global South generally. This is really the problem, as I think you were alluding to there, Brian. This is the problem with something like G7. It is really simply the 21st century incarnation of the same old imperial colonial powers trying to flex their muscles internationally in a world that is increasingly multipolar. That's really, I think, what has changed here. The colonial powers, they're simply trying to do what they've always done. It is the world around them that has changed, and they seem to be unwilling to catch up.
Right. We had the Berlin Conference of 1884, where the European powers, along with the United States and an observer status, divided up who was going to take what kind of colonies and spheres of influence for Africa. Within 18 years, all of Africa, with the exception of Ethiopia, was actually taken by these same powers that sat together in Berlin. But we're in 2016, Eric Drake. I mean, it seems like such a sort of a hideous caricature and sort of misnomer that the same powers could sit together and say, hey, you know what, we're going to determine the fate of big, big parts of the problems that the world is facing. And in fact, they have their own internal contradictions. And I want to talk about those a little bit, too. Chancellor Angela Merkel will be arriving today. The refugee crisis will undoubtedly be one of the issues that's on the platform, on the agenda for the G7. Her situation has changed dramatically, a precipitous fall in approval ratings, maybe by 30% in the last year. No solution really in sight for the refugee crisis. What do you think at the G7 the world powers will discuss in relationship, say, to that particular question?
Well, again, I mean, the Europeans have signed this quite odious deal with Turkey in regards to the housing of refugees and really the transfer agreement that they had signed. And so I think it's an open question how much more room there is for negotiation. I mean, are they willing to make larger and larger and ever larger still payments to Erdogan and to the Turkish government? Are they willing to, if they don't do that, are they willing to then finally reckon with the actual implications of their wars in the Middle East? I mean, remember, it is Libya, it is Syria, it is Afghanistan, it is Somalia, it is Yemen, it is these places that are under the bombardment by the Western imperial powers and their proxies regionally, such as Saudi Arabia with regard to Yemen. These are the conflicts driven by the United States and its European allies that have precipitated this refugee crisis. So if they're only going to be discussing sort of the cosmetic and politically palatable aspects of the refugee crisis, that's entirely possible. Will they address the root issues, such as have been laid out, I think, quite articulately by Putin at the UN last September, by Xi Jinping as well? I mean, if they were to tackle these real issues, obviously then there might be some substance coming out of these meetings. As it stands right now, it seems to be more a function of public relations and propaganda. And let's not forget, I mean, part of the backdrop of all of this is the end of the Obama administration. I mean, Obama is in legacy building mode. And if you look at his legacy, on the one hand, it's very easy to say, well, Obama has been disastrous. Obama's disaster in Libya, the disaster in Syria, the rise of ISIS, the complete missteps and miscalculations repeatedly in Ukraine. All of these could point to examples of where Obama has been a failure. But from the perspective of the ruling establishment in the United States, if you consider the strategic calculus of where the United States was in 2008 at the end of the Bush administration and where the United States is now in 2016 at the end of the Obama administration, in many ways, one could say that Obama has worked wonders for global imperialism. I mean, he's launched multiple wars. The U.S. has reasserted itself in Latin America, really working tirelessly to destroy the leftward movements in South America and in Central America. It has worked very strongly to increase, quite exponentially, in fact, increasing its military footprint in Africa, seeing Russia's economy going down, seeing China's economy slowing down, the BRICS increasingly fractured. All of these could be considered tremendous victories for Obama from the perspective of Washington. And I think that all of this is really in play when you see Obama in Asia selling the Trans-Pacific Partnership, selling his Asia pivot, trying to win Asia over to the side of the United States. For Obama, this is about building his legacy. And his legacy in Asia, like his legacy in the Middle East, is one that is dangerous when it comes to the potential for global conflict.
We're talking to Eric Dreitzer from StopImperialism.org. Eric, I hear you about that, and I hear you about the fact that Obama in some ways has rescued the position, the image, the standing, and in some ways the geostrategic leverage that had been lost during the Bush years. I got you on that one, but I want to talk a little bit more about the refugee crisis in Germany and the EU and Turkey, because the refugee agreement that you mentioned, the transfer agreement, that is essentially blocked because the Turkish government is demanding new concessions, meaning that Turkey really be allowed into the visa-free Schengen zone, that part of the EU where people can cross borders without visas. The EU is saying no to that. They have 72 new conditions on Erdogan, including revising the anti-terror law. It looks like that has frozen at the moment. So that's why I'm wondering, in terms of Merkel in particular, if Europe starts to unravel politically, the United States' ability to be the leader of that part of the world sort of power block, the NATO power block, the EU NATO power block that ultimately has the United States and Germany at its head, Merkel's in trouble, and the situation in Germany and the situation throughout continental Europe, and now with Britain and the upcoming vote with the Brexit, the possible leaving of the EU by Britain on June 23rd, again fueled by some of the xenophobia, not only but largely the xenophobia that's rising as a consequence of the refugee crisis, I could anticipate Europe really going through very profound changes and other realignments that the United States and U.S. imperial power might consider to be very unfavorable.
Yeah, and again, it sort of depends. It depends both on the political trajectory and also on the economic question. Taking the political side first, the developments in Europe, I think, are quite startling. The refugee crisis has really brought into stark relief a lot of these political dynamics that to a large extent have kind of, for various reasons, including the fact that some of them are quite embarrassing, have been sort of bubbling beneath the surface. For instance, the significant increase, rise of popularity of extreme right-wing, ultra-nationalist, dare I say, fascist forces inside of Europe who use the refugee crisis and the xenophobia that you're referring to as really a lever to gain political power. We just saw an election in Austria in which a well, more or less borderline fascist candidate was just narrowly defeated, and there's still questions about just exactly what happened in that election. That's one small sampling. We're seeing, obviously, the rise of Le Pen and the National Front in France with their deeply anti-immigrant position. Obviously, similarly in Germany with the AfD party, in Sweden, in the Netherlands, in a bunch of these countries. So the politics of Europe is certainly shifting, not only as a result of the refugee crisis, but also as a result of the growing tensions between the West and Russia. And we've seen a sharp divide, and this is something that is almost never discussed in the corporate media, particularly in the West, a sharp divide between a lot of the most influential segments of the business community in Europe and its political and financial leadership. So the business community, depending, especially in places like Germany, the economic driver of the European space, they depend very heavily on Russian energy. The sanctions have been tremendously destructive. The economic conflicts in this growing economic war has in many ways been destructive. At the very same time, Germany is fostering economic relations with regard to energy and Russia with the building of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So you see a shifting of some of these positions vis-a-vis Russia and Europe, and obviously the United States sort of lurks in the background, but the larger question that you're asking, and I think that this is the most important one, is there going to be a realignment in Europe as it pertains to these political and economic changes? The real question really is, will there be a right-wing insurgency in the Eurozone around this Euroscepticism and exit question? And if there is such an insurgency, does that mean A, the European Union unravels completely, or B, that it begins to fragment and fracture along these East-West Russia versus U.S. lines? Obviously, there are certain elements around the world who would love to see that happen. I think that Russia has been working very hard to entrench itself economically in Europe and to intertwine itself with Europe's future so that they can't simply isolate Russia. That's really part of the great game that we're seeing, and these power blocks in many ways are shifting accordingly.
Yeah, very interesting. We've been talking to Eric Dreitzer. He is a founder of StopImperialism.org. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The State Department's Inspector General sharply criticized Hillary Clinton's exclusive use of private email server while she was Secretary of State, saying that she had not sought permission to use it, and if she had sought permission, she would not have received it. This comes just days after 17 veterans of the U.S. intelligence community wrote an open letter to President Obama urging him to expedite the FBI review of Clinton's security violations so that the public can read the report soon. Does the new audit mean Hillary Clinton will face legal consequences? We are joined in the studio by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst and one of the signers of the letter from Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, to President Obama. Welcome back, Ray.
Thank you, Brian.
So this is a big deal. This is big news. This is what you were demanding, or part of what you were demanding. Talk about it.
Well, what we're demanding is that the FBI do its job. What we're involved in here is really a charade. If the FBI is listening, as I hope they do listen to such things, let me refer them to an exchange of emails here between Hillary Clinton and her chief of staff, so to speak, and also now her campaign manager. Okay, the date is June 16, 2011, and she's looking for talking points. 5:51 p.m. I need the talking points. Jake Sullivan responds, you'll get the talking points this evening. They're coming together. The next day, early, 7:52, Hillary, I don't have the talking points yet. 8 o'clock, Sullivan, we're checking. 8:17, they say they're having issues with the secure fax. We're working on it. 8:21, if they can't, turn it into a non-paper with no identifying heading and send it non-secure. Non-secure. That's a crime. That shows intent.
So break it down. So she's telling her aide, make it a non-classified document, a non-secure document, so that he can send it along. It's just talking points, or that's what it seems to be. But for her expediency, in other words, make something unsecure. In other words, was this the prevalent mode when she was using her personal email server for State Department business?
Well, this is the only smoking gun we have, but it's quite sufficient to show intent. Strip the classification markings. Now, talking points are usually not things of great urgency. This is not an indication there's a nuclear war brewing or that somebody is about to be overthrown. These are talking points. She asked for them the day before. They weren't on her desk. She asked for them early in the morning. Well, it's coming. Well, we can't get the secure facts. That means we can't send it to you securely. Well, okay, she says, well, I need it, okay? So strip the classification markings and just send it non-secure. Now, she does not have the authority to do that. Who knows what were in these talking points? It could have been gamma-type information, which is above top secret, which NSA is responsible for. It could be SAP, special access programs that the CIA is responsible for. It could be all manner of things. But blithely, she says, just strip the classification, send it to me non-secure. Again, you know, if she needed it so desperately, in the old days, what we would do is get a courier with a pistol or a gun, okay? We put it in a diplomatic bag, and he would hightail it up to wherever she was in New York.
Ray McGovern, I want to talk to you about the possible political implications, because, of course, Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party, even though it's not really concluded. Bernie Sanders is fighting hard for the nomination, but presumptively she will be the candidate of the Democratic Party. So this could be an issue, a very big issue in the 2016 election campaign. The Inspector General report, the audit that just came out, says that Mrs. Clinton, quote, had an obligation to discuss using her personal email account to conduct official business, close quote, with officials responsible for handling records and security, but that the inspectors found, quote, no evidence, close quote, that she had. So talk about what she actually did, and if this is something that other secretaries of state did, is it more profound? And talk about perhaps the political implications.
It's a order of magnitude more serious than whatever other secretaries of state. This IG report from state was deliberately extended to previous secretaries of state so they could water it down. But there's no watering it down. Even that report says her failures were singled out as more serious. Despite the guidelines, Clinton used mobile devices to conduct official business on a personal email account and private server. Now, that disregards or just prescinds from all manner of security regulations. Now, why do we intelligence professionals feel so strongly about this? Because we know, perhaps as no one else knows, how serious this can be, how people can be killed, how billion-dollar programs can be compromised, how liaison relationships that we work decades to develop and cultivate and shot down the drain, flushed down the drain by people looking on and saying, well, these high policymakers take it into their own hands to do things on a non-secure communication system. Now, people say, well, there's no proof that anybody hacked that. Well, there is, okay? This fellow Guccifer?
Talk about that. Talk about Guccifer. He's in jail right now.
Well, yeah, he's in the Alexandria jail, and the FBI is said to be interrogating him. Hopefully they're not using refined tactics to interrogate him. Here's a little thing about Guccifer. 3 years ago, he hacked into Bill Clinton's doodles. Some of you will remember that. I mean, there weren't much to speak of, but he hacked into them. And people said, oh, he probably got that from the Clinton Library. Guess what? The Clinton Library says they don't have those doodles. Plus the fact that the Clinton Library, like every other government institution, has a email system, .gov, that's much harder to hack into. So 3 years ago, it's very clear Guccifer hacked into Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton's server at the time. So the proof is in the pudding. Now, what the FBI does with the Guccifer, you know, in the Alexandria City Jail, That's what's really important. Are they really important? Are they really interested in a thorough investigation? Well, you know, I just asked them to refer to this email exchange I just read to you. I mean, isn't that enough? I mean, how thorough does the investigation have to be? We conclude, we 17 veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, that this thing is being slow-walked. Slow-walked, okay? You get the idea? Slow-walk until such time as the California primary is behind us. That's June 7th. Maybe they want to slow-walk it until the Democratic Convention nominates.
Maybe after the November election.
Yeah, but if that happens, Brian, as you probably know, then the whoever holds this information has the kind of blackmail potential that would make J. Edgar Hoover's mouth water.
Well, let's talk about President Obama's attitude. Hillary Clinton obviously was his Secretary of State in the first term. President Obama in 2009, and you cite this in your letter, the letter from the 17 Veterans Intelligence officials, Clinton's emails on her private email service referenced highly sensitive, quote, special access programs, SAP. Explain what the SAP is, because that was a President Obama's edict in 2009, in other words, to protect information. President Obama has been the most ferocious opponents of people leaking classified information or leaking any information or whistleblowing. He sent more whistleblowers to prison and for more prison time than any prisoner, president in U.S. history. Is there a double standard here with Hillary Clinton?
Well, let's address the SAP programs first. These are incredibly sensitive programs. They're above top secret. They're above top secret code word. What they involve are covert action programs, what the targets are of our drone strikes, all manner of very sensitive things. And so the idea is to make it special access. That means to limit the access to these programs to people who not only have the proper clearances, but have a need to know. In other words, they're running the program. That's how sensitive this is. And he emphasized that in that order. Now, with respect to your second question, remind me what the second part of that.
Well, what I'm asking is that President Obama seemed to be extremely vigilant. I'm using that word generously. When he's going after people who either advertently or inadvertently released classified information or information that was purportedly to be classified, he sent more whistleblowers to jail, had more prosecutions. Here we have Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, who the IG, the Inspector General from the State Department, in its audit is now severely criticizing for the release, really, of what turns out to be some classified information through her by putting it on her private email server without permission. And yet you're saying that the Obama administration or its Justice Department or its FBI is slow walking the case against Hillary Clinton, presumably, I would guess, for political purposes.
Well, that's the assumption. She wanted to keep this email traffic out of the public domain. That's clear. What exactly she wanted to hide is less clear, but one can infer. But the difference between genuine whistleblowers, and I'm happy to refer to the fact that now we have genuine whistleblowers who have been, what shall we say, we say that whistleblowing and the integrity behind it is contagious. And we know that now because a very high official in the Inspector General's office of the Pentagon has come out and revealed that the Obama administration went, and the one before, Bush administration, went after Tom Drake with a vengeance. He did nothing. He's the most straight arrow guy I ever met in my life. He never revealed any sources or methods or anything else except to private, proper channels. Now, ironically, it was his experience, 4 years of persecution, not prosecution, that Ed Snowden looked at and said, you know, if I want to tell the American people the gross violations of the Fourth Amendment that they are being subjected to, I got to get out of Dodge, right? I got to get out of town. And I have to go east because they get me if I go west. And I have to find a place where there's no extradition agreement. So I went to Hong Kong. First thing he said is, I have Tom Drake to thank for showing me how to do this to complete my mission and to get myself some sort of security. Now, what was Ed Snowden motivated by? By his oath. We all take an oath, just one oath, one exclusive oath, and that is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, that oath, the ethicists say, is a supervening value, okay? That supersedes any promise you make on a piece of paper not to reveal information more classified because it might endanger the national security. What's more endangering of the national security than violating the Constitution of the United States? So Ed Snowden had his priorities in check, but the authorities that be, how could they possibly abide by someone who would release these kinds of hard evidence and documents of crimes being committed? There are a whole bunch of people at NSA who should be in jail now for what they did, knowingly obeying Dick Cheney and George Bush. He's like, don't worry about the Fourth Amendment. You just do it, right? So there are two kinds of release of this kind of information. One is well warranted by an oath to protect the Constitution. The other one is, Bobby Gates, the used to be Secretary of State, he used to be head of the CIA, used to work for me, right? What did he say? You know, this really throws great doubt on Secretary Clinton's judgment. I don't know why she did this, you know, but it really reflects poorly on it. Well, it doesn't matter why she did it. She did it. It's ipso facto crime. Why is the FBI, more than a year after all this hit the fan, okay, why are they still dragging their feet? That's the question.
If that's the question, let me ask you then, because the IG report, the Inspector General of the State Department, has now come out with sharply critical language of Hillary Clinton. It's all over the news. And so what we see is the news. But is this a way, Ray McGovern, of getting the news out of the way, making it be a criticism of Hillary Clinton, but not a criminal indictment, not the announcement of a prosecution? In other words, make it look like the Obama administration's actually dealing with this issue, when in fact it's not really dealing with the issue, in order to clear the way for Hillary Clinton in the election. Is this another kind of smoke and mirrors?
Well, you've got it. You've got it, Brian. What it all depends on is the mainstream media. Most Americans think they get their news from the evening news or from Fox News or wherever. We put out this memorandum. The people who sign this, the list won't quit in terms of expertise. We have over 400 years of expertise in handling classified
information. You're talking about the letter you sent, the public open letter to President Obama just a couple of days ago, right before the IG made its announcement that they're sharply critical of Hillary Clinton.
Right. We didn't know that was coming. But you saw that in the New York Times, right? You saw a letter in the New York Times? No. You saw it in the Washington Post? No. You see it anywhere? Just on blogs. So if all this kind of – if there's a day's worth of publicity given this, okay, today to the IG report from the State Department, and tomorrow it's all news, old news, that's exactly what you're suggesting. They'll say, we're on it, we're looking at it, and nothing's going to happen unless Obama decides – well, I'll be charitable – unless he decides to enforce – the promise he made, the oath he took to see that the laws of this country are faithfully enforced. If he does that, he has no other option than to tell the Attorney General, you make sure that James Comey does a creditable job, make sure he finishes within the next week or so, the evidence is available to everybody, make sure you do it now. And that way he will be faithfully executing the laws of this.
Okay, I think we understand each other, but let's look at the bigger picture, the bigger politics, bigger political picture. I think we have 1 minute left, Ray McGovern. So in 2016, Donald Trump is going to run against Hillary Clinton. Maybe the Obama administration, maybe the Clinton administration want to get out this bad news out of the way early in the election cycle before it's the general election cycle. But certainly this is going to be the main talking point or one of them of the Republicans of the Trump campaign. In a way, this issue isn't going to go away.
Well, it won't go away. And I don't share your certitude that Hillary Clinton will become the Democratic nominee. The primary in California could not be bigger. The stakes could not be higher. People in California, generally speaking, are pretty smart people. So what happens on June 7th will have an incredible effect on not only Hillary Clinton, but on the chances for Bernie Sanders And I think that everyone who knows someone in California should make sure that even if the mainstream media doesn't cover this, they listen to the information that we've just been talking about.
We have been talking with Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst, one of the signers of the letter from Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to President Obama, demanding that they stop slow walking the investigation into Hillary Clinton. But now we have the Inspector General report from the State Department saying, yes, Hillary Clinton did commit grievous wrongs, but will it lead to prosecution? You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Turkey's President Erdogan has threatened to block the deal with the European Union on refugees if the bloc does not grant visa-free travel to Turkish citizens. Is this simply the latest move by Erdogan to blackmail the EU? We are joined from Turkey by Kemal Okuyan. He is a regular contributor to Seoul newspaper. Welcome back, Kemal.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, and thanks for joining us. So President Erdogan has said that Turkey's parliament will block the refugee deal. I think he actually said no bill will come before the parliament unless the EU relents and Turkish citizens are given visa-free travel to the Schengen zone. Do you see this happening?
Well, I think from the beginning, this refugee deal is in reality blocked already. It has no real base. So I think there will be a big problem with the European Union and Turkey on this issue. And we already see the outcomes that both sides say that this will not continue.
So what's the main problem?
Well, I think there are not only a single problem, there are several problems, but actually Turkey claims that it has fulfilled all the conditions related with the refugee issue. But the European Union side says that there was some other issues, especially related with the anti-terror law. So they demanded a change in this law. Erdogan and the government openly said that they will not change. So although there are some other issues, the open discussion is related with this change in the anti-terror law.
Yeah, so I want to talk about the anti-terror law, but let's go back to what the agreement actually stipulates. Let the audience know, we have a U.S. audience and a global audience. We've been through this before, but in case people aren't paying careful attention, let's go through what is supposed to be happening on the basis of the deal between the EU and Turkey in terms of management of the refugee crisis.
Well, basic agreement was, first of all, paying Turkey some money, around 3 billion euros to facilitate some refugee camps and to help Turkey on this issue. But the main issue is to stop sending migrants through Greek islands to Europe. And in turn, the European Union will receive the same amount of refugees to European Union if Turkey takes back the immigrants that try to get themselves. So this means that European Union will decide on who will enter European Union as a refugee, except some people that covers the conditions to live in European Union. That means that cheap labor, educated labor for European Union, and the rest will stay in Turkey. That is the main idea.
So the main idea here is that Turkey manages the flow of refugees, that the people who are on Greek islands trying to enter the EU countries will be turned back, sent back to Turkey, and in exchange, a certain number, I think it's 2,000 per, I don't know what the exact program is, but you can tell me. Those will then be released to come to Europe, but Europe will be essentially choosing the people it wants. In other words, more educated people, people with more job skills. So they're really treating asylum seekers en masse based on what European Union countries need rather than on the human rights or political rights or essential human rights of the individual refugees. In other words, the law, the agreement itself is a gross violation of what the EU says are its own laws, and it's a violation of international law.
That is exactly what it is. And you know what happened this week? European Union criticized Turkey to get the educated and skilled workers in Turkey and send to Europe the more uneducated people. So it turns that Turkey is also playing the game in the same way.
So it's really trafficking in human beings based on who can be useful to different economies.
It's a big tragedy, and both sides are guilty on this.
Yeah, so the EU has its own imperial needs. Of course, Germany has an aging labor force. That's been a big issue. They need more skilled workers. So if you have Syrian people who are educated or who have greater job skills, and they've been driven to their out of their country by a war that's been funded and fueled by foreign powers, particularly NATO powers and the United States, and their regional proxies, in this case Turkey or Qatar or Saudi Arabia, then those refugees have to come to Europe, are seeking to come to Europe, but most of them are turned back now or will be turned back, except the ones who are actually useful for industry.
That is true. Yes, that's true.
And from Turkey's point of view, from the point of view of the Erdogan government, it's seeking concessions from the EU that give Turkey some benefits that Turkey now does not enjoy, including visa-free access to the Schengen zone, meaning that part of the EU where there's not visas between borders. And so far, the EU is, even though they said yes, originally they're saying no. That's what's happening?
Yes, that's true. And I think in near future, there's no possibility of a visa-free travel to Schengen zone because the dispute between Turkey and European Union is, deepening.
Yeah. Let's talk about what the EU is demanding from Turkey related to the anti-terror laws. As I understand it, Turkey is supposed to meet, according to the EU, 72 different conditions to earn visa-free access to the Schengen area. One of them, though, is the revision of the anti-terror law. Talk about what the anti-terror law is and what does the EU want to do in terms of forcing Turkey to change that law. And what's the position of the Erdogan government in relationship to that?
Well, to be briefly, the anti-terror law is mainly based on enlarging the scale or spectrum to the concept of terror. So it means that what I mean is, the government several years ago increased the actions that are called as terror. So nearly all political actions can be accused of being a terror act.
Political opposition, in other words, people organizing against the government.
Yes, that's true. Even when you write an article, you can be immediately accused of helping or exercising a terrorist act. So this is a problem because nobody knows when you are going to be accused of being a terrorist.
Yeah, Kamal, okay, Jan, talk about the crackdown, say, just on journalists. I know that you had a trial set for early May. You have another trial, or that trial was postponed till September, and you have other trials coming on because you were, I guess, had insulted the president, whatever that means. So talk about that, if you would.
Well, actually, this is fortunately that is they don't accuse me as being a terrorist. So they accuse me as being an insulting Erdogan, like 2,000 or more than 2,000 people in Turkey. But there are some journalists or politicians who are accused of being a terrorist, although they don't have any relation with a terrorist act. So this law, the Turkish law, in reality, narrowed the political life or political action. So every politician is under the threat of being accused as a terrorist.
Yeah. So the difference between the journalists and those people who are, like in your case, you're being charged with having insulted President Erdogan, but you're saying there are 2,000 other people who are being charged under the anti-terror law. Is that the number?
No, I say that there are more than 2,000 people who are charged as for insulting Erdogan. But there are also some journalists and politicians who had never acted like a terrorist, but accused of being a terrorist.
Yeah, and how does the EU want the law rewritten then?
Well, they say that the law should be more accurate or more concrete. The definition of being a terrorist should be more clear, because now you can put all the things in the same basket by this law. And, of course, they say that they are concerned about, for example, the length of being in prison, arrested. So the length of the trial process is also a concern and also a dispute between the European Union and Turkey.
We've talked before, Kemal, about the forcing of Ahmet Davutoglu out as the prime minister. He was also in Erdogan's party, the AK party. He was clearly not fully on board with Erdogan's plans for a presidential system whereby the prime minister, who is technically the head of state, would be replaced by a strong president, and Erdogan is the president. But now the AK party has selected a new prime minister. Talk about that and who he is.
Well, Binali Yildirim was also in the cabinet for several terms, the new prime minister. And we can call him as a low-profile politician. He is more like a technocrat, but well-known about all the, you know, state business, especially on the energy and transport systems, which is one of the main sectors in Turkey. So he is a strong businessman. His family is very rich, and he is also accused of a real corruption. So there are clear evidence that he is also one of the guys who were engaged in corruption or dirty money. But he is, as a politician, a low-profile person, and he will not be a rival for Erdogan. I'm not saying that Davutoğlu was a rival, but he was more or less somebody who had some good relations with, especially United States and Great Britain. And Erdogan was concerned about this because he needs absolute monopoly on foreign relations and internal politics.
So let's talk about that now, because we have a real strain in the relationship, obviously, between the EU and Turkey. You're saying, Kemal Okuyan, that the agreement whereby there would be a managed flow of refugees into the EU based on what EU countries consider to be necessary or helpful to their own economies, irregardless of what the actual status is of individuals who are seeking political asylum. But and Turkey wants favors from the EU in exchange, but that agreement's not going to happen. That's what you're saying. That agreement is effectively blocked. Inside of Europe, the political climate has changed. It's shifted sharply. Merkel, the leader in Germany, her approval rating has gone down almost 30% since this crisis began. How do you see it playing out now between Germany and Turkey and the EU and Turkey? And what's going to be the likely impact inside of Turkey in terms of the political climate, in terms of political orientation, in terms of public opinion?
Well, Brian, this is a very difficult question because, you see, European Union, as you said, is in a deep political and identity crisis. It includes Germany, Britain, and even France and Italy. So the decline of the popularity of Merkel is, of course, related with this refugee crisis. But it is not only this. Germany is, you know, trying to find its way. And I think there will be great shifts in German foreign policy in near future. So the future of European Union is also now in a chaotic process. Nobody can tell what will happen. And in addition, Turkey is going on a deep political crisis. I don't say still a economic crisis, but there is a deep political crisis. And even when we, for example, have a conversation next week, maybe we will talk with some other issues because radical change may happen in Turkish political life or Turkey social dynamics in Turkey.
Well, that would be of course extremely important, not only for Turkey but for the region, and of course in terms of Turkey's relationship with the EU. Just real quick, because we're running out of time, what kind of change do you think is coming in Turkey?
Well, first of all, Erdogan is trapped. So Erdogan tries to find a way out of this, because now Erdogan has a big problem with Russia, and there are some conflicts with United States, not only with European Union, but United States. So he tries to find his way. So in foreign policy, we might accept some sharp turns. But of course, there are limits to it, because in Syria, things are going on. This is something else. And in addition, the conflict between European Union and Turkey is not something that can be solved in days. So Erdogan is trying to find a way, but I think he will face with real, real problems in the near future.
Okay, we have been talking to Kemal Okayan. He's a contributing editor to Seoul newspaper. He is on trial for several cases for insulting President Erdogan. We wish you the best luck with that, Kemal. We also hope to have you come back and talk about the Turkish political scene as it evolves, as you're anticipating some perhaps sharp changes and shifts within Turkey. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank Kemal. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.